Good morning. My name is Maya Haridasan, and I'll tell you about our work on the StarTrack system. This is joint work with my colleagues at the Microsoft Research Silicon Valley Lab. Many mobile devices these days, especially cell phones, have the ability to determine their own location. Some of them have GPS chips, and those that don't can use alternative technologies like cell tower triangulation or proximity to Wi-Fi hotspots. Thanks to this, there's been a flood in location-based applications. We have applications that provide driving directions based on your current location. We have social networks that allow you to check into places and see where your friends have recently checked into. And we have even interesting games. In this project, we've been concerned with extending the amount of information that's available to applications to include not only what places a user has visited, but also the paths taken between these locations. So the idea is that a user carrying a mobile device can periodically record his or her location, and then over time, by connecting these dots, we get what we call a track. So more precisely, as you can see in this figure, a track is a time-ordered sequence of samples where each sample is constituted of a latitude, a longitude, and a time. So we believe that tracks enable new interesting class of applications, which are applications that can benefit from mining through a user's historic location information. Consider, for example, a driving direction service that can personalize the set of directions based on the previous tracks taken by a user. To make that example more concrete, assume that this is my typical commute between home to work every day, so a path that I'm extremely familiar with. So now when I try to search for any directions to a new place, say to a new gym, what typically would happen is that I'm presented with a set of detailed directions starting all the way from my house. Now, what this driving direction service could do is mine through my tracks and easily realize that the initial set of directions is exactly the same that I take on a regular basis. And based on that, it could collapse, in this particular example, the first set of directions into a single one that instructs me to directly take the highway. So this is one example of a track-based application. But let's take a step back and consider the broader class of location-based applications. And I can classify them based on the amount of information and the type of location information that they access. So on the first row, for example, I show you some examples of applications that only use the current location of a user or set of users. These include applications that provide driving directions, that allow you to find nearby services, or that allow you to locate your friends. On the second row, I show some examples of applications that also use single instances of locations in the past. So some examples include personal travel journals, applications that allow geotagging of photos, or applications that allow users to leave post-it notes or recommendations in different places. And then finally, in the last row, I show some examples of what we envision to be track-based applications, or applications that can benefit not only from accessing location as single points, but also from accessing them as strings of points connected over time. One example is the personalized driving directions that I just described to you in the last slide. And a second example is a ride-sharing application, where the application can mine through tracks from a group of users and try to identify automatically potential ride-sharing partners. So, before I mention this, applications can be also further classified as personal in case they access a single user's data at a time, or social in case they access data for a group of users at a time. So StarTrack is a system for enabling this last class of applications, whether they're personal or social track-based applications. Notice that nowadays most applications which use location data have to collect and manage their own silo of location information. Instead, with StarTrack, they have a common infrastructure that can manage tracks and that enables sharing of this information across different applications. So here is a higher-level overview of the StarTrack system. We have a number of StarTrack servers sitting in the cloud satisfying requests from clients, and that store and manage information using a number of StarTrack, database servers. I should make a quick parenthesis here to point out that most modern database servers these days have some form of geospatial support, by which I mean that they have specialized data types for storing geometric objects, and they have specialized indexing techniques to efficiently address these objects. The StarTrack client API exposes a number of track-based operations, including insertion operations that take a set of samples that have been collected and break them into tracks, and other retrieval, manipulation, and comparison operations. Some examples include operation that can compare two tracks for equality, and another may include an operation that takes a reference track and it will fetch all tracks that are most similar to it. So I'll talk a little bit more about the API later in this talk. So despite the simplicity of the architecture, building a track-based application proved to be harder than we originally anticipated. And there are a first main set of challenges that we faced. The most basic problem arises from the fact that tracks are a set of sampled coordinates, and sampling is inherently error-prone. So even the most simple operation of comparing two tracks becomes inefficient and error-prone if we do it in this raw form. As we studied the need of applications that could use and benefit from tracks, we also realized that they need to combine complex operations in order to be able to narrow down the information that they're interested in. So coming up with a flexible interface was an important challenge as well. Third, we also needed to come up with efficient implementation of the operations that we identified in the API. So we took some measures to do that. Even though geospatial databases have come a long way, tracks are particularly complex geographic objects, often containing hundreds of points. So when we try to handle a large number of these objects, solely relying on the underlying database proved to be inefficient. And finally, Star Trek should be scalable and fault-tolerant, and we took some well-known techniques to ensure that it was so. Since these are not particular to tracks, this last item, I won't be talking more about this in the talk. Instead, I'm going to be focusing on the first three challenges that I just described. So the first basic problem with handling tracks comes from the fact that tracks are a set of sampled coordinates, and sampling is inherently error-prone. So consider again the same track that I presented earlier in this talk, shown in red dots, and consider a second track, shown in blue dots, which was taken while traveling the same path. Comparing these two tracks for equality becomes difficult and error-prone if we do it in this raw form. So instead, in Star Trek, we canonicalize tracks based on their underlying network. Canonicalization here means that we're converting a track from its raw form into a new one that only goes through a set of standard points. And there are a few advantages to doing that. So by drawing the coordinates from a set of standard points, we can employ additional techniques to make retrieval of tracks from the database more efficient. And we can make comparison not only less error-prone, but again, more efficient. In turn, by making comparison more efficient, we can more easily identify highly similar or identical tracks. And Star Trek exploits that to maintain a separate list of non-duplicate tracks per users. So the idea here is that, the intuition here is that users typically follow repetitive travel patterns, and therefore we have a large number of duplicate tracks. So if Star Trek maintains the separate list of non-duplicate tracks, you can often use that to accelerate operations by not having to operate on the larger collection. The second challenge we faced was related to coming up with a flexible API. So as we identified and studied track-based applications, we realized that they have a typical mode of operation, which involves narrowing down a set of tracks that they're interested in, for example, tracks for a particular community or tracks for a particular geographic region. Then they need to do further operations on this narrow down set. For example, they might sort the tracks based on some criteria, or they might further narrow them down based on some more complex similarity criteria. And then finally, they only fetch a small number of tracks after all these manipulations. So to address that, we introduced the concept of track collections in our API, which are abstract groupings of tracks. The introduction of track collections had a couple of benefits. First, it matches this set of three phases that we identified. So now we have operations to create track collections, manipulate track collections, and then finally fetch tracks from these track collections. But perhaps more importantly, it also allowed us to improve the performance of operations. It led to performance efficiency, implementation efficiency optimizations. Notice that since tracks only need to be fetched at the very last stage, we can combine operations and execute them at the client a priori. Then this prevents a necessary exchange of messages between client and the server. And we can further delay the evaluation of these operations until tracks are actually fetched. Besides that, track collections enable caching, since they allow Star Trek to handle sets of tracks which are repeatedly accessed together as a single entity for the purposes of caching. And furthermore, they allow us to build specialized in-memory data structures to operate on these repeatedly accessed tracks. I'll tell a little bit more about this in a little bit, but let me start by telling you about the API in a little bit more detail. So as I mentioned, we have operations now that match to each of those three phases. A client starts his interaction with the Star Trek service by issuing a call to make collection, which will create a track collection from scratch. This operation takes a set of criteria as input, which can include attributes on users, geography, and time. And it also takes a Boolean, which allows the application to specify whether they want duplicates to be omitted from the returned collection. Once it's created collections, it can use a number of manipulation operations. Here are some examples. These operations take a track collection or a set of track collections, and it will return a new track collection as an output. One example that I'll mention that I'll come back to later in this talk is get similar tracks, which takes a track collection, a reference track, and a threshold, and it will return a new track collection containing only the tracks that are at least as similar to the reference track as given by that particular threshold. And finally, there's an operation for fetching tracks out of a track collection. So let me show you this API in use by showing a ride-sharing application and how we can implement that. The goal of this application is to identify the best ride-sharing partners for a given user, in this case, myself. And it has two main parts. In the first part, the application starts by creating a new collection, giving it some criteria which specifies my name and some time boundaries, and it requests the duplicates to be omitted. Then it sorts these tracks based on the frequency of how often those tracks occur within that collection, and we finally just fetch the first track. So this should, in the end, return the most representative track for the particular user. The second part involves a little bit more expensive computations and starts by creating a big collection involving tracks from all employees from the same company where the user works for. In this case, the employer would be Microsoft. And again, between 8 and 10 in the morning. Then the application passes this track collection together with the morning commute track from the user to a call to get similar tracks, which will fetch all tracks which are at least 80% similar to the track. And then finally, which fetch the top 20 tracks out of this collection. There's a last step that I'm not going to talk much about in this talk, which involves finding the owners of the tracks that we identified and making sure that those tracks are also frequently traveled by those owners. But instead, let me focus a little bit longer on this second part of this application, just to bring back some of the benefits that I described in two slides back. So the calls that make collection and get similar tracks happen at the client server, since they don't need to be evaluated until the call to get tracks. And therefore, the evaluation is also delayed until GetTracks gets called. Once GetTracks is called, StarTrack is going to evaluate the chain of operation, and that will involve some fetching data from the database as well as some additional computation at the server. A second point that I should point out here is that StarTrack caches partial computations. So the ride-sharing application could make use of that and reuse the Microsoft track collection for future calls where it tries to identify partners for other users of the Microsoft company. So the takeaway from here is that by introducing track collections into the API, we can make the interaction between clients and the server more natural. And not only that, we can also enable further optimizations in how we evaluate these operations. So this leads me to the third challenge that we face, which is to efficiently implement the operations in the API. So as I hinted in the last slide, evaluating operations involve two steps, fetching tracks from the database and doing further computations in memory. So we did some work to accelerate both of these components. At the database level, the main intuition that we followed was that tracks tend to be highly repetitive. And there are two main sources of redundancy that lead to that, both of which I've already touched upon in this talk. First, as I mentioned, users follow highly repetitive travel patterns, leading to a large number of duplicate tracks. And second, thanks to track canonicalization, now all tracks share a same set of standard points. So thanks to all this, to both these redundancy sources, we now incorporated additional tables at the database level to make retrieval of tracks more efficient. Once tracks have been brought into memory, StarTrack also accelerates further operations by implementing specialized in-memory data structures. For example, it builds quadtrees to accelerate operations involving geographic constraints, and it may build another data structure called a track tree to accelerate operations involving similarity constraints. There are more details about all these changes in the paper, but I'm going to focus for the next few slides on track trees and similarity constraints. So for the purposes of this explanation, let's assume the very small track collection containing only four tracks that I'm going to present next. We have two tracks, A and B, which are identical and share 5 segments, S1 through S5. We have a track C, which has tracks segments S1 to S4 in common with the previous two, and then 2 separate segments, S6 and S7. And we have a track D, which shares segments 1, 2, 3 in common, and then they have their own segments 8 and 9. So we define track similarity to be the length of all common segments between the two tracks over the length of all segments that occur in either of the tracks. So this is equivalent to the Jacquard index for computing set similarity. In this example, track similarity between tracks A and B is 1, which is the maximum value, as we would expect, since they're identical. And similarity between A and C is the length of segments 1 through 4, which is common to both of them, divided by that same length plus S5 and S6, S7, and which belong to either tracks A or C. So the key point here is that computing similarity between tracks is a fundamental operation, and unfortunately there is little support at the database level to accelerate this operation. So in order to accelerate that in memory, we created this data structure called a track tree, which we built on top of a particular track collection. So I'm going to fast forward a little bit. This is what a track tree looks like for the particular track collection that I just described. And as you can see, it's a hierarchical data structure where nodes represent segments or sequences of segments in the track collection. More specifically, leaf nodes represent individual segments, and intermediate nodes represent sequences of consecutive segments. The idea when building this track tree is that we're trying to compress the representation of tracks. So we're trying to minimize the number of nodes that we need to represent tracks in this collection. For example, after we constructed this, tracks A and B can both be represented by a single node, S15, whereas tracks C and D can both be represented by 2 nodes each. So now let me show you how we construct this track tree. We start by creating leaf nodes for all segments in the collection. And then we start iterating over all the pairs of nodes for consecutive segments, and we merge nodes based on the number of tracks that goes through these pairs of nodes. So we always start by merging the nodes that have most tracks going through them. So in this case, we could have picked S1 and S2 or S2 and S3 since they both have 4 tracks going through them, but we started with S1 and S2. And we repeat that process iteratively until we cannot merge any nodes anymore. So we can use this track tree data structure to accelerate a number of operations. For example, we can use it to accelerate get similar tracks, which is that operation that I just described to you. Or we can accelerate another operation called get common segments, which is used by a personalized driving directions application. As an example for get similar tracks, if we have a new track shown in orange, I don't know if that's too visible, the process of identifying similar tracks involves mapping that track to nodes in the tree, and then iterating over those nodes and using the tracks that also go through those nodes as potential candidates. There are more details in the paper. Unfortunately, I can't delve too much more on that. And as I mentioned, track tree is one example of an in-memory data structure that we use. We also use quadtrees for accelerating our other operations, and we could implement further data structures for new operations in the future. So with that, I'm going to move on to the evaluation session. And I should mention that we evaluated different aspects of the Star Trek system, but I'm only going to present a set of 2 sets of experiments in this talk. First, I'll present some experiments that show that the track tree approach outperforms some alternative approaches. And then I'm going to show some experiment results of the performance of Star Trek when we hit it with requests from 2 sample applications. For all of our experiments, we use tracks which were synthetically generated based on the salient features of a real data set which was collected in Seattle, so not too far from here. And in our experiments, we used up to 9 Star Trek servers and 3 database servers, all of which had similar hardware configuration. So first, I'll show you some results of computing get similar tracks when using the track tree approach against some alternative approaches. Just to remind you, get similar tracks takes a reference track, and we'll try to find all tracks that are most similar to the reference track out of a collection of tracks. So the first alternative approach we considered is that tracks are stored in a materialized view in the database, and then we use geospatial features of the database to fetch all tracks that intersect the reference track and bring that to memory. And then once they're in memory, the candidates, we sequentially scan them to identify potential matches. In the in-memory filtering, we assume that the track collection is in memory, and we use a pre-built dictionary that maps points to tracks to pre-filter tracks that intersect the reference track. And then finally, in the in-memory brute force, we sequentially scan all tracks and compare their similarity against our reference track. So here in this graph, I show the query time in logarithmic scale as we increase the number of tracks in the collection, and which we're looking for similar tracks, up to 100,000 tracks. As you can see, the track tree approach performs at least two orders of magnitude better than the alternative approaches. But I should also point out that track trees and other in-memory data structures have costs associated with them. So in this graph, I show the time in seconds as well as the memory in megabytes to build and maintain such track trees in memory, up to 100,000 tracks. So as you can see, it may take up to 2 minutes to build a track tree for 100,000 tracks. So this cost is only justified when we issue repeated operations against a track collection. For example, in the case of ride sharing, it makes sense to build a track collection for a large community or a geographic region and keep it around to satisfy requests from a different number of users. We also evaluated the performance of StratTrack against a couple of sample applications that we built. These two applications have somewhat different characteristics, since one is a personal application and the other one is a social application. So the first one is the personalized driving directions that I mentioned. And since it's a personal application, each instance of this application will build small track collections involving only tracks for a given user at a time. So these are fairly small track collections. The main, more complex operation in this particular application is a call to get common segments, which could be accelerated through the use of a track tree. But once again, since this track collection is small, it could be that the collection has not been cached in memory either. So we considered two scenarios, one in which the track collections had not been cached in memory a priori, and a second one where the track collections had been cached and we had track trees pre-built for those. So as you can see, we can satisfy 30 to 250 requests per second depending on whether the tracks are cached or not. The second application is the ride-sharing application, where the application builds a large collection involving tracks for a group of users. So it's a really big collection, and in this case, we have to pre-cache the track tree in memory before the experiments, otherwise it would take too much time. So in the case of ride-sharing, we're able to satisfy up to 30 requests per second with a single server. So both these applications are highly parallelizable, and we noticed that by increasing the number of StratTrack servers in those experiments up to 9 StratTrack servers, we could easily scale the request rates that we were able to satisfy. So these are the only results that I'll present in this talk, but for more information, I'll ask you to refer to the paper. We have more experiments there. So the takeaway from this talk is that StratTrack is a scalable service designed to manage tracks and to enable the construction of track-based applications. Amongst the challenges that we faced, we narrowed down three of them in this talk. One of them was handling tracks in the raw form, coming up with the right API, and efficiently implementing operations in the API. And we deployed a number of techniques to address these issues, including use of track canonicalization, use of track collections, and use of in-memory data structures to accelerate these operations. We have a working infrastructure, and we would be happy to have users of that. So in case you're interested, please talk to one of the authors who are in the audience. And with that, I conclude my talk. Thank you very much for your time, and I'd be happy to take any questions if there are.
Hi, I'm Fitz Nolan from Yale University. Very interesting work. Do you have any notion of pairing intent or content with the track? I could think of cases where, you know, maybe one application you would try to access, you know, the track for another application, but they have no related content, so maybe the user doesn't want that.
Right.
Or also maybe you would want a case where you want tracks for driving directions to be labeled as such, so that way only driving applications can access it, or, you know, maybe
right.
The recommendations scenario would be a little better if the application knew the content of the track, like knew the reason the user traveled that track.
Right. Now that's a good question. We do have the concept of associating metadata with the tracks, and different applications could associate different metadata with the tracks.
Okay.
And in terms of the privacy aspect, which I guess you're touching at by different users not wanting different applications to access this, We'd expect that we could have access control lists where mm-hmm. the user defines which applications can access the information that they're interested in.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. I was wondering whether how you handle errors, how you handle sort of you know, a device reporting some location that's probably wrong. Do you have sort of any, yeah.
Okay. So the way we handle errors, it's through track canonicalization. So there is a pre-step where we pre-filter points which are completely, which are obviously erroneous, which we can identify based on the path. And then track canonicalization further clears up some other errors by trying to match it to the underlying network.
So how do you know that the point is an error?
Basically, the algorithm will identify what points are completely outside from the path. So it, there might be an error associated with track canonicalization and map matching, but the algorithm will try to identify.
So I guess when you say I'm going to identify this point being an error, how do you know what the truth is? That's my question. Are you doing sort of some sort of statistics aggregation and saying, oh, this is a point that I've never seen, so you know, I'm just going to remove it. You know, I have to see a point 10 times until I'll actually think, yeah, it's not an error.
What
do you use?
Right. We don't use anything like that. We just rely on the underlying track canonicalization algorithm, and I guess it could be improved based on statistics like that. Okay. But it's the black box that we use for track canonicalization. So, thanks.
Hi, Petros Maniatis, Intel Labs. So I have a more speculative question for you. I can imagine a class of applications in which I want to be able to share track-based information, but I want to still keep it private. I mean, this is a perhaps a funny version, but I could imagine saying, give me the walking directions that don't intersect with my ex, right? I don't want to share necessarily where I'm going,
right,
but I want to get some intersection that has to remain private.
Right.
I'm guessing that the kinds of data structures that you're using so far are not very amenable to privacy-preserving
right.
analysis. Have you guys thought at all, and girls, thought at all about how you would do something like this, or does it sound hard? I'm just asking for speculation. I don't.
Right. We've thought about it. Unfortunately, we haven't really come with solutions yet. It is a hard problem. There's been a lot of research on trying to anonymize tracks, I mean, anonymize location information and so on. And when it's tracks, it becomes even harder because we're actually tying more information together. And we would like to have, because as I mentioned, we could use some sort of access control policies to prevent user, to allow users to specify which application has the information, but we would also would like to have a way to aggregate certain information that do not require user permission, but some sort of differential privacy kind of a thing. We haven't really done much in that direction yet, but we're thinking of that.
We should talk.
Thank you.
Brad Morey, HP Labs. Could you put up your results slide again, the number of users cached and uncached? Can you explain why the curve goes straight up after you reach the maximum? Is it some, like, are you thrashing the virtual memory? I looked at the paper and it didn't have any justification for that. Why is the knee in the curve? What's causing that?
I guess this is a typical graph for network queuing properties. At some point, thanks to network packets, a lot of packets being received, we're not able to satisfy more requests, and the latency just goes up.
So is it CPU bound at that point, or is it network saturated? What's the bottleneck
CPU
there?
Bound. Combination of CPU and a network.
So you're not going out of the cache on the machine, it's not thrashing with the virtual memory machine?
No, it's mostly, sorry, it's CPU bound.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Sorry, that should have been the answer, yeah. Thank you.